Disrespect will take you places you can't get to from here. Disrespect entertains with a look at the challenges and sometimes the successes of people with disabilities who have taken from them or are denied the full choice of possibilities to affect for the better their own lives or the lives of those above them. This week, Disrespect brings you two interviews, a very intense pair of interviews with no time for music and hardly any time for breaks. Our first interview is with the mother of disabled infant, now on life support at the Stollery Hospital and fighting for the maintenance of life support. His name is Isaiah May. His mother is Rebecca May. Disrespect welcomes to the show Rebecca May, mother of baby Isaiah James May, in Ronald McDonald House near the Stollery Hospital in Edmonton. Hi, Rebecca.
Hi, how are you doing?
Yeah, good. I understand it's snowing there.
Yes, it is.
All right. Well, it's been snowing here, too. When did you first realize that you had a bigger job than you thought with your son, Isaiah?
Well, it was probably in the few weeks to follow his birth that I realized that we have a road to go on. It would be a long road, but I never did think that I was going to give up. I was going to keep going until I, you know, wasn't able to go anymore, kind of thing.
All right. So you were not aware at the birth that Isaiah might have problems?
No, it was the last little bit of labor.
Mm-hmm.
His heart rate plummeted and it wouldn't come back up, and he was born with a cord around his neck.
Right.
And flat line.
Right. Interestingly, most of my siblings were born with the cord around their neck, but they didn't have a 40-hour labor.
Yeah.
Yeah. So what were the first steps that were taken on Isaiah's behalf?
Well, when he was born flatline, they did CPR on him for 2 minutes, and then they got him resuscitated.
Right.
Then he was flown via air ambulance to Edmonton Stollery Hospital, where he was put on a cooling blanket, which is kind of, it looks like a bath mat, actually. And
yeah.
It's folded around him, and cold water runs through it, and it puts the baby in a very cool state, like about 32 degrees to
right.
keep the body temperature at. And then it's a 3-day treatment, and what it's supposed to do is reserve the baby's brain and help promote healing.
Huh? Okay.
Mm-hmm.
And what was the outcome of that?
Well, after about a day, they didn't feel it was necessary to keep going on the treatment, but we insisted that we wanted to keep going.
Right.
And they don't feel like it helped him any.
Right.
However, we did continue and we did finish it.
Right. Have you seen any charts to confirm or deny their statement that he's not improved with the treatment?
Yeah, I have seen the whole chart.
They
gave that to me, yeah.
Yeah. And from what you've seen, does it support their view that the treatment didn't bring him any improvement?
Well, see, there is where we're divided. He continued to do everything that they said he would never do. We had a meeting, and I remember them saying he will never live past a few days.
Right.
He will never move. He will never grow. They said his head would shrink because his brain would turn to mush.
Right.
He never opened his eyes. And they listed all these things.
Right.
And then we started to see all those things. And it would have been different if we've only seen, you know, one or two things.
Right.
But we've seen all of them and then more. And to us, that was just, it was encouraging.
Right.
And it seemed like the more time he was given, the more he does. And then we actually met a little boy who's 12 years old who was born the same way Isaiah is.
Oh, and really?
It took him many years to recover. He opened his eyes at two, and
wow.
And he didn't learn to talk or walk or anything until he was eight.
Right.
But now you never even guess. He is fully functioning, healthy, very smart 12-year-old boy.
Very smart.
Yeah, very smart.
I see.
And
what does he do? Does he go to public school?
He's homeschooled.
All right.
But he's very, very smart. He runs around just, and he keeps up with all the other kids.
Wow.
He's here, yeah. So, you know, that was very encouraging.
That's quite a story. Kids, I remarked once to a mother about her child. She was talking about the rapid changes, and I was saying, they're like seashells. If you hold them up to your ear, you can almost hear them grow. And I said, I don't know how they survive such rapid growth and change.
It,
in a sense, the growth itself, even for a healthy baby, is traumatic. And she said, her response was the tenacity of the soul. And that phrase made it onto the button you push to get to my show at the station.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's very true. Yeah. Mothers know their children more than anyone else.
I wouldn't argue with that.
Mm-hmm.
So what's the future from here? You're in a kind of difficult situation where other people have assumed authority over your baby's life. And so what does this mean for you and the baby going on out?
Well, right now we're in the middle of the court battle. On the 19th, we will receive a timeline as to how long we have.
Okay.
Maybe you'll get a
list of goals that are expected to be met in that timeline?
Yes.
Okay.
We are to find a pediatric neurologist and a neurologist, and then get them to assess Isaiah. And we're also going to be doing other research as well.
Is this after the 19th?
Yeah.
Okay. So if you will get a timeline on the 19th, you won't get a negative end to this at that time. So you'll get some kind of timeline, will you?
That's what we expect, yeah.
All right. And then working with that timeline, you'll do further investigation to see how Isaiah can best be helped towards his goal.
Yes.
All right. Well, he sounds like he has quite a challenge ahead of him and quite some achievements to look back on when he's met some of those challenges. It's not a bad foundation for becoming an adult, to know that you can rely on your body for those things, that the good that you need. You're mostly born with it, and you just have to let it work, is the way I see it. I don't know. I won't speak for the doctors or for you, but that's the way I see it. I acquired a disability, and my surprise was how little my doctors could do and how much my own body could do to overcome it.
Yeah, with time, these children in these situations have survived. You just have to give them a lot of time and a lot of therapy. And the brain, you know, it's people don't understand it fully. It's used to be so cut and dry, but now people are discovering new things about it and that it can regrow and rewire itself.
Yeah. Yeah. And he has all his childhood ahead of him for that to happen.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, and we'll take him every step of the way through it.
Okay. Was there something that you particularly would like to say?
Well, not really, except that I just wanted to thank everyone for all the amazing support, and I receive so many letters and emails every day, and it makes a difference
really?
In the day for me. It really does. And
Do you want to give an address or for sending letters?
Sure. You can either send a letter to Ronald McDonald House. Uh-huh. I'm not sure of the address, but if you looked it up online, it would be an address.
In Edmonton, there's just one?
Yeah, just one in Edmonton.
All right.
Or there's my email, which is RebeccaMay@gmail.com.
R-E-B-E-C-K-A.
Yeah.
May, M-A-Y. RebeccaMay@gmail.com. Yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
Appreciate your time spent with me, and I hope you're having a good day inside out of the snow.
Yeah, thank you.
All right.
Okay.
Bye. Our next interview on a different day is with two advocates, both of whom have experienced crises with maintaining life support for the disabled child, Sam Sansalone and Barbara Farlow. Disrespect welcomes advocates Barb Farlow and Sam Sansalone, Barb from Ontario and Sam from Alberta, to discuss the ongoing conflict around baby Isaiah in the Stollery Hospital in Edmonton. Welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Thank you, Jeff.
Okay. You mentioned that the baby Isaiah conflict has produced a large following on Facebook. What's the Facebook group called, and what have you noticed in terms of a following and its growth?
I understand it's over 30,000. What is it, Barb? 33,000?
34,700 last time I looked.
Okay. It's going up about 1,000 a day, maybe.
Okay, yeah. And what's it called?
Prayers for Isaiah James.
Yeah. Okay, all right. Well, we've got the context how the conflict arose. What's left is the legal outcome and the ethical implications of the legal outcome. In this case, I defer to Barb. She recognizes the issue of the limited resources of a health system, whether it's public or private, and the need to commit it to productive causes. But where we seem to fall afoul is that there is no process for allocating these resources, and the allocation of them to people with disabilities, whether infants or adults, seems to fall into a kind of dark zone where decisions are often made in secret or in private or according to unspoken agendas. And I understand this was not the case at the Stollery Hospital, but is that the issue that you see?
Well, I think there's a problem with this all across Canada with our intensive care units, whether they be neonatal intensive care units, pediatric or for adults. I think that the average member of the public believes that we do have infinite resources and that they can receive care according to their wishes and with full consent. And I think that becomes challenging, the reality.
Okay. Yeah, I guess the definition of recovery, too, this whole issue that you introduced on our last interview, quality of life, despite the fact that numbers can be attached to that, it's very subjective to what you attach the numbers to.
That's right.
Yeah.
That's right. And everybody makes different choices as well.
Yeah.
So, that's always been my concern, is that because people don't realize also that futility is more and more often seen as quality of life futility. So when they say that...
Is that futility with an F? Because you're very quiet now.
Yes, futility with an F.
Okay.
Right.
All right.
Yes.
And Sam, you and I spoke about that National Post article in which it was revealed that people who are profoundly disabled and cannot communicate in any visible way can actually communicate through brainwaves, which can be read to indicate their reception of an issue, their consideration of an issue, and their decision regarding an issue. And yet the doctor still said that doesn't mean they should be able to say whether they want to live or die. And that didn't sit well with me.
That is disturbing, isn't it? We all have different ways of communicating. We have different languages in the earth. Why should one person be denied a voice of decision just because it's a language that's not part of our particular culture or usual form of articulating words and ideas?
Yeah. Yeah. So where does that leave us with one pot of resources and a lot of individual beliefs and standards in the medical community about what is quality of life, and some decisions that have to be made that can't be unmade? We really have a system in need of fixing here, don't we? Or a process in need of fixing.
Yeah, and I think a big part of it is educating the public and having public involvement. In particular, in my opinion, we need representatives of the public and representatives of some of the vulnerable groups right there at the policy table at the Ministry of Health. I think that's where it all starts, where decisions are made regarding who receives care and who doesn't. Just as an example of that, in my province, somebody made the decision that infants with pre-existing conditions, and I can only assume that would be a genetic condition or a birth defect, are not allowed to have the same monitoring devices or at home as other children would have.
Really?
Now, you know, I have to wonder who was involved in making that decision.
Oh, dear.
Is that a fair decision? Does that pass by our commitment to human rights or our constitutional rights?
Yeah.
Well, that's just one example of it.
I think the nuance in that is that they're not necessarily saying it's not allowed. They're saying they're not going to pay for it.
Right.
When you look at the price of the monitor,
Yeah. Pretty
much putting most families in a out of the picture as far as immediate ability to afford this kind of a device. So I think that in itself speaks to what's really underlying. It's resources and money.
Well, it's interesting because they speak of limited resources as if the pot were pre-existing, but in fact, I think the health care budget in Ontario is about half the provincial output, money-wise.
Yes.
And
yep,
so,
that's right.
And half of your provincial taxes and the health transfer from the federal government has been taken off you, and then you're offered the opportunity to pay for what you want. And that's not right.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if it's a life or death decision, and all the money that would normally take care of all your care is gone, and they're telling you you can't have any.
I think it even goes beyond that. There's a hypocrisy to that whole dynamic. I remember when Katya was in the transition phase from the hospital to home, and we weren't completely certain what to expect because she was so early on in her infancy.
Yeah.
She had regular access to a sat monitor at
okay.
the hospital.
Right.
It wasn't a question. So if it was valid there and then,
yeah,
what difference, you know, should it make medically once you reach home? And of course, there's a period where you can test that the kid's doing well without the monitor. And from her cardiac condition
right.
perspective, that was, you know, by then clarified that she didn't need the sat monitor for that purpose.
Right.
But there's a whole other area of medical complication for these kids that doesn't necessarily manifest in the first few months, and that's central nervous system-based apnea.
Yeah.
And that would have been a medical reason to have a monitor at home.
And you didn't get one?
She didn't. We were in the process of arranging one through another process. As it turned out, Katya just did so unusually well in that respect as well, that it didn't, you know, end up becoming necessary. But if you want to be sure about that sort of thing, you have to transition appropriately from having an apnea monitor to not having one.
Right.
And I think the way it was imposed on us was inappropriate, even from a medical standpoint, and hypocritical in the sense that, you know, you get it in the hospital.
And you don't get it.
For functions, purposes, you resolve one of the purposes but not the other. So why would the transition to home be without giving due diligence towards it?
Can you tell, and Barb, you should do the same, can you tell the listener, Sam, remind them who Katya is?
Katya is our third of four children. She's currently 8 years old, born in 2001 with an underlying chromosomal syndrome called full trisomy 13,
right.
which essentially means that she doesn't have a single normal cell in her body.
Okay.
You don't die from that condition, per se, if you have that generally. What becomes life-threatening or challenging medically or developmentally is the defects that causes to various systems and organs. So,
okay.
You know, they call them midline defects, but really it could be anywhere.
Okay.
But midline would include brain, heart, and you know, some other key organ areas.
All right.
In her case, there were a couple of initial salient medical issues that needed surgical intervention, but you know, besides the GI one, the most significant one was the cardiac
right.
surgery. And why this came so much into play is that it's a highly valued and sought after medical intervention.
Okay.
For children, and they don't have unlimited resources. They can't do everyone's cardiac surgery in the world and have enough resources to do them necessarily. In Katya's case, they told us initially that we had the choice to pursue this life-saving intervention or not, and they couldn't recommend it because of some what they described as quality of life issues. They refer to her as having a condition that is a lethal condition. We found these things to be untrue when we did further research, and so when we decided to accept the surgery, which had been initially offered to us as an option, all of a sudden it wasn't an option anymore.
Okay.
They were only fooling about us having a choice, and they had no intention of ever granting it, so we had to basically fight for her to get the cardiac surgery.
Okay.
And that resulted in a successful advocacy, and she became the first full trisomy 13 child in the country to get at least that kind of cardiac surgery. Barb, you heard something about
a child that was older than Katya had the surgery before a genetic diagnosis was made.
Oh, okay.
Which is interesting.
It is, because the child was, I believe, about maybe 1 or 2 years old, so the disability would have been manifested and evident. So it's interesting that one could deduce that she obtained the surgery, even though she had the disability, it wasn't a genetic disability.
Oh, okay.
Also, my understanding is this baby never went through a NICU.
That's right.
At the, you know, the primary tertiary center for care of neonates in Ontario, which is the hospital for sick children in Toronto. Katya did go through the NICU at that specific institution, and Annie went through that NICU, or at least not the NICU, but the PICU of that specific institution.
So NICU, neonatal, and PICU, pediatric intensive care unit?
Yeah.
Right.
Okay.
It's simply a biological age thing. There's very little difference other than...
And Barb, do you want to encapsulate your experience that qualifies your advocacy?
Yes. Well, you know, the condition, my daughter Annie had the same condition as Sam's daughter Katya. And the reality is that the future is bleak for a good many of them.
Mm-hmm.
And prior to Annie's birth, we knew that we might need to make some very difficult decisions, and we were prepared to make them.
Mm-hmm.
At the time of my daughter's death at the age of 80 days, within 24 hours arrival at the hospital, we believed, because the doctors had informed us, that she needed surgery, she wouldn't survive, and ultimately her rapid and sudden decline shortly thereafter, we believed to be of natural causes. However, obtaining the records afterwards and after thorough research, what we discovered was that the surgery that was described was by no means certain, and the coroner's office subsequently agreed with that statement.
Right.
And we also came to learn that there were multiple violations in narcotic policies, including the removal of narcotics without a doctor's order and missing records. So to this day, which is now 4 years later, we truly do not know the cause of our daughter's death, and we don't know if she could still be alive, if there was treatment that could have helped her. She was, like Sam's daughter, very mildly affected with a genetic condition. As the range of manifestations go, so that I guess was what launched my advocacy and research, I guess, into our healthcare system and how we treat neonates with various genetic conditions or birth defects that can be terminated before birth.
And for a listener who may be interested in future shows, I understand tomorrow you're going to a meeting to discuss this with the government.
That's right. We've been having. Very serious concerns with the coroner's office. The coroner made the statement that all of the narcotics were accounted for, and that a document stated that, and had refused to provide the document. And since then, what we've come to learn was that we've never had a copy of the official final medication record, and the coroner's office refuses even to answer whether they know of the final medication record or whether they have a copy of it. They refused also to say yes or no to the question of did Annie receive the lethal quantity of narcotics that had been removed
right.
And is detectable in post-exhumation toxicology tests.
Mm-hmm. Just to point out how suspicious that is, because if they didn't give Annie an overdose of fentanyl or any dose of fentanyl,
the records would
why
show.
Why wouldn't they automatically come back and say, absolutely, we didn't, there is no fentanyl involved in this.
Right.
Why haven't they, within four years, come forward with such a clear statement?
Yeah. Well, right. Where is baby Isaiah at as compared to the process for each of your children?
I'd say very early on in the advocacy. The advantage that this family has, I guess, right now, from what you see in the news, is that they have a legal case going on that is standing between a hospital agenda, you know, to remove life support,
right,
and the parents' wishes, which is to give baby Isaiah some more time before even talking about that kind of decision. And I can tell you one parallel. I remember when they were trying to encourage me and my wife to withdraw the prostaglandin that was keeping Katya going while we awaited the surgery,
right,
or while when they tried to discourage us from pursuing the surgery over and over and over again over the months, that one of the key features was that, for us, was that Katya was not regressing.
Right.
So if the child is having in Katya's case especially, a relatively normal neonatal experience.
Right.
Feeding, enjoying that process.
And
getting connected with parents and family.
Yeah.
And is not regressing.
Yeah.
And is, in fact, developing.
Yeah.
In various measurable and observable ways. Why would you say there is a quality of life issue, even if there is something to be said of what might happen down the road? Right now, this kid is enjoying
life.
And now, I know the situation is a bit different with Isaiah James May, in that there are, you know, he's would appear to be in somewhat of a comatose state, but the point is he is not regressing, and in fact is making progress. And as we've learned over and over again, decades of, you know, medical interventions for people who are in that kind of a state, some of them come out of it.
Right.
In surprisingly positive ways. So why would you direct what in effect becomes a death sentence, a medical death sentence?
Right.
It just is, it's mind-boggling.
How do you see it, Barb?
Well, you know, it's interesting, Sam. You said that you compared the situation now with your early experiences with Katya, and rightfully so. I see the situation with baby Isaiah and where the family are at as a situation that we never got to, and that we regret that we never were able to have a full and complete discussion about what was wrong with our daughter, what was an accurate diagnosis, and to make best interest decisions for her in partnership with the physicians. That opportunity never existed. The doctors told us something, we believed it, and we were put in a position of having to make a very hasty decision. And as it turns out, without informed consent. So I have to some degree, I suppose, commend the scholarly staff that they are taking this through a process of sorts. And unfortunately, the process has then come to court. But that's the due process that should always exist when parents don't agree.
Right.
There should be the ability for them to obtain a lawyer, to obtain an outside expert opinion from a doctor, and for a judge then ultimately to make a decision. It's unfortunate that the matters come to that, but it's appropriate that decisions are made through a process.
I'd like to add that I don't think a family should even have to go through that. First of all, of course, it should be available if the situation calls for it, but long before that happens, there should be a dialogue and openness of becoming informed. You know, for under law, these kinds of decisions have to be made under the condition of informed consent. And part of being informed involves a parent seeking, you know, other opinions if they wish, or having access to the chart. One of the things that I found really disturbing when this first hit the news is descriptions that the parents were being denied access to the chart as much as they'd like to. Or even if they weren't being denied, discouraged. That this is in t- entirely inappropriate in a condition where a life and death decision has to be made,
yeah.
and the parents need to be fully, duly informed, and they've chosen a route that yeah. is then being blocked or discouraged or outright denied. It's, I'm sorry, but in that respect, to the degree that is true, I cannot, that is sufficient for me to not commend Stollery
right.
on the action they've taken.
Yeah. Okay.
If that's what the parent chooses,
yeah.
they want to see the chart, then
yeah.
it should be eased. Something, the road should be paved for them. There should not be hurdles placed in the way.
Or yeah, I hear you. Yeah, so there should be a process to enforce the availability of information for them.
I would agree with that. Even though it's supposed to be provided automatically, it is not. I know I had to fight several different times, at least two different institutions.
Mm-hmm.
I had to push and push to get access to the chart. That is not something a parent who's day and night involved in the. Medical situation of their child, they should not have to be adding to their burdens by having to fight the hospital
no.
to look at the patient chart.
No, I agree. I agree.
You would think that all of the information that was given to the parents was comprehensive and was accurate. There would be no problem sharing the chart.
Yeah, that's true too, eh?
Okay.
The written records are what you're looking for now, and you're making the same case there. If all the information that you received to date is true, why are the written records not available? And it would be the same thing with a patient's chart. Right?
You know, it's this whole, you see this pattern repeated, or this kind of flavor of entitlement not being open, not being transparent. You see it repeated at different levels in the system. You see it at the physician level. You can see it at the that hospital administrative level. You can see it at the coroner's level.
Right.
It turns out when you look at anything, now it looks like the correctional ministry's level. I mean, at what point do we achieve transparency? What does a parent have to go through to achieve transparency? And you know, that reminds me, Barb, of something you were told. Finally, they did break with their avoidance. Did they not give you one statement just a couple of months ago about what the cause was of Annie's death? And when
yeah.
that was analyzed more carefully, we came to a quite shocking realization.
Right.
Do you want to describe that?
Right. Well, the coroner, initially, we had been told it was complications of the genetic condition trisomy 13, which is kind of, given that our daughter died in the intensive care unit, that's a pretty vague
right.
Reason to cause her death, complications of a syndrome.
Right.
I mean, surely they can be more definite than that.
Yeah.
So just a few months ago, the new chief coroner came up with a redefined cause of death. He said it was due to the devastating complications of trisomy 13, so we added an adjective there.
Okay.
And then he said it was also due to central hypoventilation. Well, first of all, there can be devastating complications of trisomy 13. As Sam also well knows, but his daughter and my daughter did not suffer from those, especially
right.
it's a serious brain defect.
Right.
Secondly,
she's referring to holoprosencephaly.
Yeah,
to what?
That's right.
Example.
To what?
And secondly, central hypoventilation. Well, we had to scratch our heads over that a little bit. And then after a bit of research, what we realized was that is exactly what happens when somebody dies of due to the administration of narcotics. What happens is it depresses the breathing function from the brain, and the carbon dioxide builds in the system, and the person dies.
Right.
So we immediately followed up with the chief coroner asking the question, was the central hypoventilation due to the administration of a dose of fentanyl, the missing narcotic?
Right.
And the response was, there's nothing further this office can do for you.
I see. Okay.
And do you remember, Barb, that moment, I mean, when we were talking about that, the light bulb went on,
mm-hmm.
that my goodness, this statement fits what happens with fentanyl.
Yes, exactly.
So
yeah. primary risk of fentanyl use is central hyperventilation.
So it's like they want plausible, it looks like, to any thinking person who sees, puts all the, lines up all the ducks of the unanswered question.
Right.
And you put them all together and you see how they relate to each other, and then you get a statement like this. What it looks like is they want plausible deniability.
All right.
They want to be able to say later is, yes, she was given fentanyl, or no, she wasn't, depending on what, you know, gets discovered when
okay.
the whole forensic process is completed. Like, if you exhume the body,
okay.
you'll know if there was fentanyl. So this statement, in the meantime, gives them an opportunity for it to be interpreted as, you know, it wasn't fentanyl, it was something else just from the restricted airflow or whatever. Or later they could apply it in a completely different way that would admit to, you know, fentanyl use. So therefore, they can claim that they never lied about it.
Oh,
you understand what I mean?
Right. That, they never said, but they never lied.
Yeah, they can say, well, we never said she wasn't given fentanyl, and we gave this description, this hypoxia or whatever, I can't remember what the exact words were.
Hypoventilation.
With an overdose of fentanyl.
Right.
So why don't they just say it now? Why don't they just come out and say there was no overdose of fentanyl? Why won't they say that?
At the Stollery Hospital for baby Isaiah, has there been any comparable withdrawal of care or intervention to either reduce monitoring or increase the risk of complications of his situation?
I would sure have questions if I were in their shoes.
Oh, okay.
Only because of what you've already seen and what is, you know, patently known about the
similar cases
or the, you know, proposed disuse of it and the conditions under which that was proposed. That's a red flag, and
yeah.
any parent who's in this situation should view any such occurrence as a reason to dig deeper.
Right, right.
See what else might be going on. And I don't know. I don't know the answer to that question, but I would sure be duly suspicious of it.
All right.
If I was a parent in those shoes.
Yeah. Barb, and I'll ask you too, Sam. What hangs in the balance with this independent assessment we're waiting for baby Isaiah and his future?
The hospital had granted 30 days from that period. The parents were requesting 90. I don't know how you can come. This is one of the unusual things to me about this whole process is when you're attaching temporal aspects to something that should really be based upon clinical changes.
Right.
Whether a clinical development takes 1 week or 90 days or 180 days is not as important as whether the progress is happening.
Right.
An extrapolation of that improvement points in a direction that is positive. It's one thing if they're declining, but their clinical status is improving. And the medical expectations or predictions have already, on multiple measures, have already failed. So the baby's brain is not turning too much. The head size is not decreasing or staying the same. The head size is increasing. The baby's not...
What is increasing? I didn't make out that word.
The circumference of the head.
Oh, okay.
So, in other words, there is an aspect of there's a component of normal neonatal experience. Growth, gaining of weight.
All right.
And girth and... These things are, as I understand it, if you read what's available to the public, these things are occurring. And if the predictions from the institution and the physicians in charge of this case were opposite to what we're seeing,
mm-hmm.
that in itself is a reason to put the brakes on.
Yeah.
And not only put the brakes on the idea of removing the ventilator, but also put the brakes on the whole concept of applying a temporal limitation to this. It's not so much about the time, other than the money
mm-hmm.
Aspects, the resource aspects. It's not so much about the time that it's taking. It's, is it going in the right direction?
Yeah. I have never read an article in the paper that says, this guy's too stupid to live, and the guy's, alive and animate and standing in front of them, I've never read that. But they seem to say that about babies all the time.
Yeah, because there's nothing imposing about them in their view. They haven't even articulated the means to, sort of establish a voice for them, let alone the language,
A couple of other things with neonates that you don't get with others. One of them is the fact that often they're perceived as not quite being people yet.
Oh, dear.
And they can be replaced in 9 months or so.
Oh, dear.
Model.
Yeah.
So there's this, you know, that they're dispensable. That that's often the thought, and that's something that Peter Singer from Princeton has often said. The other thing,
Well, Barb, before you move on, I wonder if you'd be willing to share what you had told me about what this neonatal administrator told you about.
Right. A director of a NICU in a Canadian hospital even told me that if he has two babies with the same, level of difficulty, and one of them has a younger set of parents who can always have another one, the other set of parents are older and they've had maybe in vitro fertilization three times.
Right.
He said, "Well, I'm going to try harder for the baby with the older family, the older parents."
Right.
And you know, that is just, you have to scratch your head about that for a little bit.
Yeah.
That is just sort of classic public health care thinking.
Yeah.
The Americans would never go for that, because what's happening in the United States with your baby when you've paid your insurance is absolutely independent about what's going on with the next person's baby.
That's true.
That's their business.
That's true.
There's no correlation.
Yeah.
Who are they treating, the child or the parents?
Yeah.
Well, the other thing I think that we have to be mindful of with issues in the NICU, possibly as the government might perceive them, is that a child who is allowed to survive and will have lifetime disability and perhaps complex medical care has a huge price ticket on their head.
Right.
And you know, we can't deny that this might be an impetus that we're not going to try so hard on that child because of the future costs. The government, in a public health care system, the government who perhaps reduces the number of NICU beds that forces certain decisions to be made and choices to be made, inadvertently perhaps, or maybe worse, is not only saving the future medical costs of that complex child, but the educational, social costs as well.
Right.
So, I mean, it's dark and it's sinister, but it's a windfall of savings.
Yeah,
my answer
to that is, although it wasn't a disability at childbirth, look at someone like Stephen Hawking. You know, I've heard it said that, you know, we could be getting rid of the next Beethoven or the next,
yeah.
You know, and we don't know, you know, because we don't have the money.
Yeah.
I just sort of have this terrifying image that NICU, especially tertiary center NICUs, are almost have an assigned or assumed or, you know, quietly understood role of nipping in the bud that very, very expensive citizen that is going to be draining provincial resources at a rate far beyond average, and in their view might contribute less than the average citizen, and so it's like there's decreasing returns there that have to be accounted for, and all of a sudden miscreant practices can be permitted because there's a financial and society cost supposed justification for it. And this is just an impression, but it's one that's not based in just fantasy.
Marine,
I've lived through different phases of this now. I don't know that there's any one person who sits down and dreams up such a strategy that can save the province millions upon tens of millions or more dollars just by making a few strategic decisions at the neonatal level.
Right.
It's a terrifying thought that has that warrants investigation and analysis.
Right, because, you look at Ontario here, quite mysteriously, we haven't published infant mortality rates for 5 years.
Oh.
What's that all about?
Oh.
So Canada has been publishing a national rate that is void of 40% of the population.
Oh, really?
Well, Barb, correct me if I'm wrong, but would it not be true that the statistics are still being compiled, they're just not being published?
Well, we can assume that, Sam. We're not sure, but it's hard to believe otherwise.
Why would they stop collecting the data?
Well,
it doesn't make sense.
The explanation given is that there's a sort of a data mismatch in that the parents must submit the birth certificate so that the death certificate can be matched in order to determine that there was an infant mortality rate.
Yeah, and, but how was that different 5 years before?
Well, that's a good question. That's a good question. And why has it taken us 5 years to figure this out when all of the other provinces across Canada have got no problem at all? Yeah, that's
or what else is it that happened 5 years ago that might be, you know, making them not want to publish?
Well,
I can think of something that happened not about five years ago.
That's funny you should ask, because what happened 5 years ago, roughly, was the initiation of, in certainly in Ontario anyway, the government's fetal alert network, which is a sort of a genetic birth defect center, so that if if anyone was screened positive or if there's something found on an ultrasound, then...
May I apply another term to it that I've heard?
Uh-huh.
Search and destroy mission.
Yeah, yeah. Some people, Margaret Somerville, I believe, coined that phrase, search and destroy. So it's coincident, it seems, with the initiation of the Fetal Alert Network that we ceased to publish our infant mortality rates. So the other thing, too, is... you know, when we think about how decisions are made, one time I had a meeting with a health policy professor at the university, and I said to her, you know, it seems to me that hospital policies, which are written to reflect a patient's rights and the laws, are sitting on a shelf gathering dust, and nobody follows them. They're not implemented. There's no accountability. And all decisions are made, and hospitals are run based on performance indicators and objectives, all tied to funding. Now, to me, that was a pretty insulting statement to say to a health policy professor. That's how I would have taken it. So I was shocked by her response. She said, well, I hope so. So, you know, it seems that there's a general disregard for the laws that relate to the care of patients. And there's a good reason for that. The kind of patients that we're referring to, in this case, we're talking about vulnerable neonates with conditions probably related to disability, well, they have almost no value in the court of law. So really, all of these laws...
You should elaborate on that last statement, this access to justice issue.
That's right. So, you know, to take a case in which it seems that there was medical malpractice causing death involved, the value of a child with disabilities, say like Katya or like my daughter, might be worth $25,000 to $50,000. Because that person was never going to earn an income. Yet the cost of litigation, on the other hand, and remember you're up against a large hospital with a lot of resources, is certainly in the order of $500,000. So it just would be not in anybody's sane mind to pursue that unless they had money in the order of $1 million hanging around.
Mm-hmm.
So, and then we look at the court
of law. And what that translates into is not only... accessible justice denied a family that's encountered this kind of discrimination and wrongful death. Not only is that the case, but you also have the complete, almost complete lack of a deterrent within the system, because they know that in the worst case, should they be discovered, the cost to them is absolutely minimal, as long as you can weasel out of any criminal implications. The cost savings for effecting the strategy of, you know, nipping the expensive life in the bud, the cost savings to the province are so enormous compared to the very minimal risk. So it's from a financial standpoint, it's a great, it's a tiny risk to reward ratio that is that eliminates the natural deterrent that should be system.
Well, you've indicated...
And when we look at the basis for rationing or priority setting, as they call it, sounds a little nicer, one of the inputs to that is the values of the majority of the public. And this I heard from a doctor who developed priorities and rationing in Ontario. And now when you look at the values of the majority of the public for neonates with disabilities, well, I think that the values of the public are well known by the decision to terminate most of the pregnancies that relate to fetuses that might have these conditions. So their lives are possibly not deemed to be of little value to the majority but, because they would have terminated.
Just to qualify that statement, you said they're not well known, but that doesn't necessarily mean they're well based. And what I mean is this, that parents who would make a decision to go along with either withdrawal of life support in a neonatal, or postnatal situation, or pre-birth in an abortion decision kind of situation, they may not be adequately, truly informed about what they're really getting. I know what we were told, and this was after Katya was born. After Katya was born, we were told it's incompatible with life. It is a lethal condition. We were further led to believe things like, or they tried to make us believe things like she might never smile, might not recognize her family, won't interact socially, and all of these things are so far, far from the truth as it manifested in Katya's life. So I think part of the problem isn't so much that necessarily that the decisions are being made as much as the decisions are being made without being duly informed or because of being misinformed. I think a lot of parents who were in my family's shoes, had they known that these kids grow up, if they survive infancy, they grow up to be quite, quite possibly very happy children that have special contributions to them. So a lot of these people might not have decided to, pull the plug on life support or pull the prostaglandin while awaiting surgery or any of these other interventions, might not have even decided to abort had they known the truth of the full range of outcomes that were possible for a child with that particular kind of chromosomal.
Right.
We're supposed to be practicing medicine, and the movements in medicine, ostensibly are to improve its family-centered care componentry and aspects. And I know there are a lot of initiatives being made. It's become a buzzword and a hot topic in healthcare in North America. And to be sure, there are family-centered care programs that are being advised on and well implemented and are on their way to doing good things. But there are others that are merely token and fake and too expensive in a number of ways for hospitals to take maybe as seriously as they could. I feel for, I feel strongly for an aspect of the other side, and that we simply can't afford right now as a society to do everything we would like to for everyone.
Right.
And I hope I don't offend people here. I actually understand that rationing might have to take place.
Yeah.
But what I do not accept is that the rationing would be done on an unethical or inequitable basis. It has to be fair. I wouldn't be surprised if, in retrospect, 50 years from now, people could look back at our era and find out that, my goodness, maybe we had a eugenics in numbers of victims that maybe rivaled what we've seen in terrible regimes of the past. When you think about all the babies who are voiceless and defenseless being eugenicized, if there's such a term, because of disability and their cost to society or perceived cost to society and perceived inability to contribute equally.
Well, this is what Barb and I were talking about off the air for a minute. In your position again, Barb, was?
We were talking about that resources are not recognized in the law in a precedent case.
Yeah.
Related to withholding care. But that doesn't really...
Well, Sam is making the case that there is no disincentive to this kind of discrimination, and in fact, some kind of counterweight, some kind of countermeasure needs to be put in place so that this doesn't happen. But you're making the case that we don't even, implicitly or explicitly, that we don't even use the laws that we have, that the court has not addressed some of these issues that are key.
I mean, in theory, these...
I would actually agree with that as well, absolutely.
Yeah. I mean, in theory, these things should never happen. We have laws related to consent. We have criminal laws related to active and passive euthanasia, the withdrawal of care without consent or where it might be beneficial to a patient. So in theory, we have a great system and we have great hospital policies that correlate to those laws.
Mm-hmm.
That's been my experience anyway. However, none of these things are implemented. Nobody's held accountable, and the law is just not accessible to children like this.
Okay. All right.
I do believe that there are plenty enough laws within extant legislation to address and prevent these kinds of occurrences and unfair manifestations of inequitable rationing. I have no doubt that the legal language is already in place, especially if you include criminal law. But it's not only the access to justice is not only in the post-mortem sense. It is also in the live day-to-day event of keeping your baby safe in the healthcare system. Because I have been in situations with Katya where her life was in danger.
Right.
It was clinically clearly the case, and there were easily defined medical reasons for it, and I could not access help from the system that was immediate enough and open enough to making a quick enough case of it for her benefit.
Right.
I will share this, and that I will tell you that members of the family that is related to Isaiah James May, an extended family, there is a real sense, and it must be crushing to them, that the hospital has given up hope, and that this was the case from the very beginning.
Okay.
How does a family go into a situation like this about their own child and have to cope with not only the reality of what their child is facing, their family is facing, the potential loss and challenge, but that the hospital where they've gone to help, get help for the child, the hospital has given up hope from the very beginning?
Yeah. Okay.
Where is the medicine in that?
Yeah. Final comments from you, Bart, and from you, Sam?
Well, I guess we're all really hoping for a miracle for little baby Isaiah. And I think that goes for the healthcare team as well. I mean, everybody would love for him to open his eyes, start breathing spontaneously long before any court decisions have to be made. And so let's keep that hopeful thought.
All right. And Sam?
Hopefully he won't even need a miracle. I would certainly welcome that. But there is progress. If there's clinical advancement in his status, whether it's for reasons of miracles or simply what was going to happen with Isaiah anyway, or through careful administration of interventions, that's great. I think we need a miracle in our healthcare system,
okay,
and in our justice system, so that we can become the ethical society that some of us pretend exists.
Yeah,
but we ought to. Really, really ought to exist. I think we're capable of it.
Okay. I thank you both for spending so much time on this subject on the show. Hopefully it sparks some thought in all the players involved in this conflict.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
If you can't access a Disrespect broadcast, you can now listen to the show wherever you're near an internet download. Disrespect is archived at www.radioforall.net. That's the number 4, not the word, radioforall.net. You can find the shows under its name, Disrespect. Tune in at showtime to see if something more topical hasn't displaced the show that we planned. Disrespect is digitally edited from live telephone and studio interviews.